The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Today on the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, Tom Cotton examines how the Kavanaugh madness will help the GOP come through in November.
So what the Senate Democrats have awoken across the country in Senate races. Now the House Democrats are bringing in their own races by threatening to investigate and impeach.
We look at the effort to intimidate Republicans.
This is something the left is proud of. The violence, the anger, the rage, it's all coming from the left.
Heather McDonald examined the cases where accusers have been caught lying.
If you've been raped, you do not want to get back together again with your rapist. You want that man in jail.
And the shocking statement from former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
You cannot be civil with a political party that wants to destroy what you stand for, what you care about. That's why I believe if we are fortunate enough to win back the House and or the Senate, that's when civility can start again.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. on the East, and on demand 24-7. You can learn more at HughHewitt.com. The week began with the new Supreme Court Justice, Justice Brett Kavanaugh. And while on the surface the highly partisan mess is behind us, the ramifications will likely continue into the midterm elections in November. Polls show American voters did not like the way Democrats in the Senate handled this serious matter. They took the goodwill of the Me Too movement, weaponized it, in a number of ways undermined it. And it's all backfiring on the Democrats. Voters saw through it and did so with just a month left until the midterm elections. Earlier this week, I discussed what led to this sentiment with Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton. Let's get to the key thing. And I remind people, Senator Cotton, before he became a politician and after he is a Harvard-trained lawyer, walked point for patrol in the suburbs in the city of Baghdad during the surge as an Army Ranger in command of soldiers. And so I don't believe the demonstrators or the screaming mobs would have intimidated you or Todd Young or Joni Ernst or Dan Sullivan, any of the combat veterans. But what was it like last week in the Senate, and what does that say in the hallways of the Senate buildings, and what does that say about what's going on in politics?
Even more so than Baghdad or Afghanistan, I recall basic training where I essentially had Drill Sergeant Norton screaming at me for 9 straight weeks.
Yeah. So this is nothing compared to Drill Sergeant Norton?
I say that advisedly, is that, you know, part of what they do in basic training is try to teach you to perform under pressure with lots of distraction around you. And I'd say that the scene on Capitol Hill was something like that last week. You know, our office buildings were open to the public. You know, Arkansans were coming in to see me. I was sitting down with a large group of Arkansans, in fact, and there was a large group of protesters in the hallway screaming at Joni Ernst across the hallway. So I walked in and I said, I don't know what you guys did, but those people are really angry at you. it was disruptive to a degree. Not so much for me. I mean, I'm fine, but I do feel badly about all those Arkansans who are coming in to try to make their case for this or that policy in the government, or just for grandmas and grandpas who had their kids there for a Capitol tour. It made it very hard to move around. But it was much worse than that. I mean, Susan Collins was getting death threats, and her staff was getting rape threats. She had to be escorted by a security detail to and from her home each morning because a crazed mob was protesting outside of her home a few blocks from the Capitol. That's when the radical left in the country has gone too far, when they're protesting Susan Collins at her home for voting in what she thinks is the right way for this country. It's fine to protest peacefully outside the Capitol. It's fine to give money to someone's opponent. It's fine to knock doors for them. But going to Susan Collins' home to protest her is a bridge too far. And most Americans realize it's a bridge too far. That's one reason why so many Americans across the country are revolted by the crazed mob the Democratic Party under Chuck Schumer whipped up over the last 3 weeks.
Is there any doubt in your mind, Senator Cotton, that this was planned long before it was unveiled? And by that I mean the leak of Dr. Ford's letter I don't know who did it, but I believe it was part of a campaign that was set up to occur exactly when it did. Do you agree with me?
I believe the Schumer political operation was behind this from the very beginning. We learned last week that a woman named Monica McClain was Ms. Ford's roommate, and she was one of the so-called beach friends who encouraged Ms. Ford to go to Dianne Feinstein in the partisan Democrats on the Judiciary Committee. Well, it just turns out, just so happens that Monica McClain worked for Preet Bharara, the former U.S. attorney in Manhattan, now a virulent anti-Trump critic on television, and former counsel to Chuck Schumer. So I strongly suspect that Chuck Schumer's political operation knew about Ms. Ford's allegations as far back as July and manipulated the process all along to include taking advantage of Ms. Ford's competences and directing her towards left-wing lawyers who apparently may have violated the D.C. Code of Legal Ethics and perhaps may face their own investigation by the D.C. Bar.
Now, when we have a summing up of the consequences of this in 4 weeks at the polls, I don't believe Americans are going to forget. I think they're going to vote to make sure Mitch McConnell remains the leader in the Senate and Kevin McCarthy, the new Speaker in the House. Do you agree with me that this lasts, that this left a mark on American politics?
Yes, I think most Americans, Republicans, but as well as independents and some sensible Democrats in places like Arkansas, are appalled by the left-wing mobs that Chuck Schumer and the Senate Democrats whipped up over the last 3 weeks. I traveled to New Jersey last week to campaign for my good friend Jay Weber, a Republican nominee for Congress in northern New Jersey, and the seat Rodney Frelinghuysen is retiring from. The single biggest applause line of the night was for Brett Kavanaugh, and for standing up to the House Democrats who are already threatening to investigate and impeach not only Donald Trump, but Brett Kavanaugh as well. So what the Senate Democrats have awoken across the country in Senate races, now the House Democrats are bringing in their own races by threatening to investigate and impeach a fine man and someone who will be a stellar justice. I think there's going to be a consequence for those Democrats in 4 weeks today from the polls. But remember, to you, voting has already started in a lot of places, and our people are starting to go out and vote to show their revulsion at the left-wing mob tactics.
While Democrat leaders are doubling down on their attacks, more on that later, there are some traditional Democrats who are troubled by the new tactics. Salem host Mike Gallagher discusses a recent article.
Brian Dean Wright wrote a piece at FoxNews.com saying, post-Kavanaugh, the Democrats have no plan B. They thought this was going to work. He says the Democratic Party is gravely wounded. They are bleeding out. Surveys show that the once formidable Democratic lead in generic polls has collapsed. The Senate seats in North Dakota, Texas, and Tennessee are all but lost. Prospects of a Democratic House have fallen too. Progressives have no one to blame but themselves. The media led the way, he writes, with astonishing speed and inaccuracy, with USA Today going so far as to suggest Brett Kavanaugh was a pedophile. Activist groups organized pop-up protests in elevators and hallways with cult-like followers chanting back to their leaders how they'd target their next victim. It happened again to a media personality over the weekend here in New York City. Did you see the video of activists hounding and taunting and harassing Brian Kilmeade from Fox News? They got on a subway. They followed him all the way onto the subway. And they start yelling, "This is Brian Kilmeade. He says racist kinds of things." And then they got people on the subway all fired up and revved up to start yelling at Brian, too, filming the whole way. This is what they do on the left, chasing people out of restaurants. The video of Brian being chased through the streets of New York is unnerving. You'll see these two guys hounding Brian. The guy sort of trolled Brian by taking a selfie with him, and then he started berating him, and then he started taunting him and harassing him. And they're proud of it. They post this on social media. This is something the left is proud of. The violence, the anger, the rage, it's all coming from the left. You know, very few incidents are coming from the right. Of course, the left will yell, "Charlottesville, Charlottesville." I'm not talking about the vicious, violent lunatic who plowed into the crowd with his car. This great piece by Brian Dean Wright. He was a former CIA guy and a Democrat, writing these words. The most embarrassing theatrics were those orchestrated by Judiciary Chairwoman Senator Dianne Feinstein of California. Her piece de resistance was planting a faded actress-cum-agitator behind Justice Kavanaugh in a transparent attempt to curry favor with the Me Too movement. There wasn't a lot pointed out about Alyssa Milano, although Saturday Night Live did a very funny thing and had a cardboard cutout of her, her peeking up over the shoulders of people. It was perfect because that's what she was doing. She was making sure she got injected into the Kavanaugh hearings. At one point, taking pictures with her phone, which is forbidden in the chamber. They had to tell her to put her phone away. Not to be outdone, Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey had his own role to play. Quite proud of himself, saying, "This is about the closest I'll probably ever have in my life to an I am Spartacus moment." Democrats now sit defeated, facing a very unexpected and existential crisis, he writes. Fundamentally, there is no plan B beyond the plan A culture war that they thought would work. If the last few weeks are any indication, writes Brian Dean Wright, the American people have seen enough. Polling data shows that while their tactics certainly riled up progressives, it equally angered conservatives. And as ever, independents remain a wild card, gently breaking for the GOP as of today, but tentative and dispassionate in their support. Yet with no new message and no credible messengers, Democrats are stuck in finding fresh ways to try to reach those voters, many of whom are white and conservative-leaning. The time for Democratic bravery, he writes, has passed, and so the fight continues with less than a month to go until America heads to the polls. That's an eternity in politics, of course. There could be another October surprise that might give Democrats a shot at taking back the House and the Senate. It'd be a chance for national redemption after a disastrous Kavanaugh performance. But if the last few weeks are any indication, the American people have seen enough. No one could blame them if they simply choose to walk away. Interesting analysis from Brian Dean Wright over at FoxNews.com. I don't want to put the wet blanket over this big, big victory. This is a huge victory for our country. A lot of people are smiling today, and for good reason. But this is step one. We won the battle over the weekend. Now we got to win the war. And you've got to vote on November the 6th. I cannot say it often enough. You cannot stay home on November 6th. If you stay home, you risk this country being thrown into a state of utter chaos.
Go to townhallreview.com for the rest of Mike's take on that and sign up for the podcast. You'll get the best of talk radio every single day. Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
You cannot be civil with a political party that wants to destroy what you stand for, what you care about.
She was almost our president. The Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The accusations against Justice Kavanaugh set off a nationwide debate on when you do and do not take the word of an accuser. The legal rules have been in place for some time and for good reason. But in an extraordinary move, they were tossed aside by Senate Democrats. One of the more troubling arguments, accusers have no reason to lie and you are guilty until proven innocent. A new sort of McCarthyism. Heather McDonald wrote an article on this very issue. She joined Salem host Larry Elder.
Well, Heather, your article, Trauma and the Truth, Guess What Feminist Now Constitutes Rape, was jaw-dropping. Let me just read you one paragraph, get your response to it, Heather. Quote, in 1985, Ms. Magazine published a study by psychologist Mary Koss that gave rise to the stat that 1 in 4 college females would be sexually assaulted during college. The study also found that 42% of putative rape victims went on to have intercourse again with their alleged assailant, behavior inconceivable in the case of actual rape. In fact, it was the researcher herself who classified the subjects as victims. 73% of the women whom the researcher designated as rape survivors said they hadn't been raped when asked directly, end of quote.
Well, that's a methodological sleight of hand that has stayed with every single campus rape survey since the 1985 Ms. survey. The believing in this alleged epidemic of campus rape means ignoring females' own characterization of their experiences, something that allegedly the feminists tell us one should never, ever do.
Quote, in 2015, the Association of American Universities, AAU, conducted a sexual assault survey at 27 selective colleges. The vast majority of survey respondents, whom the AAU researchers classified as sexual assault victims, never reported their alleged assault to their college's rape hotlines, sexual assault research centers, or Title IX offices, much less to the campus or city police. And the overwhelming reason that the alleged victims did not report is that they did not think what happened to them was that serious, end of quote.
Well, you know, we have been hearing two mantras from the radical feminists during this absolute hysteria meltdown of identity politics insanity of the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. One is always believe survivors, meaning always convict males. You should not subject a so-called self-described survivor's claims to any kind of empirical testing. Number two, the reason that so-called survivors do not report is because the patriarchy makes it so painful for them to do so. They confront such horrible skepticism from these Title IX offices and whatnot. No, that is complete BS, Larry. The reason they don't report, when you ask the people whom the rape researchers classify as rape victims, why didn't you report, the overwhelming reason is they say because what happened to me wasn't serious enough to report. Now, I maintain that in the case of actual rape, which is the most terrifying experience any female can have, A, you would never voluntarily have sex again with your rapist, and B, you would never claim that that experience was not serious enough to report.
Heather, you talked about the Columbia University mattress girl. Tell us about that.
Well, this was a girl who made fame for herself and endless accolades from feminists in Congress, such as Kirsten Gillibrand, for this stunt of carrying around a dorm mattress for a year or two, like Jesus with his cross, to protest the fact that the guy that she belatedly identified as her rapist was not expelled by Columbia. And the reason Columbia did not expel her alleged rapist was because Emma Solkowitz, in the aftermath of what she 8 months later would decide to report as rape, sent this guy a series of fawning emails begging to get back together with him, saying, Paul, I love you. I need to see you. Where are you? We need to have an Emma Paul chill session again. Clearly, somebody who is enamored of this guy and ultimately became disgruntled because she did not persuade him to become an exclusive couple with her. But anybody who reads these emails sent immediately after the voluntary sexual coupling that 8 months later she converted into a rape would conclude without the hint of doubt that this was something that was completely untraumatic to this woman. She kept begging to get back together again. Again, if you've been raped, you do not want to get back together again with your rapist. You want that man in jail.
You'd think the backlash against Democrats' attacks on Kavanaugh would cause the leaders to settle down. It's done just the opposite. Democrats pretty much across the board are advocating more crude tactics to get what they want. And this messaging went all the way to their top. Here's the quote from Hillary Clinton.
You cannot be civil with a political party that wants to destroy what you stand for, what you care about. That's why I believe if we are fortunate enough to win back the House and or the Senate, That's when civility can start again.
I discussed this with Senator Mike Lee on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Congratulations on your role in confirming a very able and good man to the United States Supreme Court, Justice Kavanaugh.
Oh, thank you, Hugh. It was an honor and a pleasure to be part of that as a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I'm just glad we got him through.
You had some great exchanges with him in his first appearance that were substantive and discussing of the Federalist Papers and other things like that, but then it degenerated. I have to ask you an unpleasant question. Were you or any member of your family physically threatened in the process of confirming Justice Kavanaugh?
I was doxxed, meaning our personal information was released, our personal address, where I here in Washington, where I live in Utah. As well as my personal cell phone number. And it's terrible. It leaves us feeling very unsafe. My wife has had to be followed to the park by the local police. It's not a pleasant thing. This is completely unnecessary, I would add. It's completely unnecessary to descend to a point in our society where, with confirmation of a Supreme Court justice, someone has to feel physically threatened by the release of such information.
Well, you know that former Secretary of State Clinton went on with Christiane Amanpour yesterday at Oxford. Let me play you the start of her cut number 9 so you can comment on it.
Not be civil with a political party that wants to destroy what you stand for, what you care about.
So, Mike Lee, Hillary Clinton saying you can't be civil with a political party that wants to destroy what you stand for. I don't think you want to destroy anything, but I am shocked that Secretary Clinton said that.
I am too, Sue, especially because she went on to say in that same clip that if Democrats can win in this election, then we can go on and be civil after that. In other words, according to Hillary, civility is what happens between two groups of people in her group. That's what it wants. That's appalling. That's not civility. That's the opposite of civility. I've spent a long time since I've heard someone who purported to be a responsible member of society say something so awful, and I demand that she retract it.
I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Coming up, a mother chooses not to abort.
He's 5 years old now, and she stays awake at night and watches him sleep. And she can't believe that she could have destroyed something so precious.
And now that mother stars in a movie about one of the most notorious abortion doctors ever. The Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. What abortion doctor Kermit Gosnell did to live babies outside of the womb is beyond shocking. Kermit Gosnell is the abortion doctor who for decades operated a horrific abortion facility in Philadelphia. He was convicted in 2011 and has been called the most prolific serial killer in U.S. history. Anne McElhaney wrote a book about Gosnell and helped produce the movie titled Gosnell, The Trial of America's Biggest Serial Killer. She discussed the story of Gosnell and went on behind the filming with my friend and colleague Dennis Prager.
She's co-producer of the new movie Gosnell and author of the book Gosnell, The Untold Story of America's Most Prolific Serial Killer, is now out in paperback. I don't easily shed tears at a movie, and I didn't think I would, honestly. I knew the story, and I was just curious to see how Anne and Phelim had put it into a film. But I was overwhelmed. And you don't do it. It's not an angry film. It's just, we'd like you to know what happened. And I strongly recommend that you folks see it. It'll just, if nothing else, it'll make you think. And we have to think. We can't just feel. It'll make you think. So it's coming out in how many theaters?
In at least 600 theaters, and we're adding theaters all the time. We've had some problems with theaters too, you know, but yeah, it'll be over 600 theaters And you're right, exactly right what you said, you know. People need to know, they need to stop feeling stuff and they need to know things. And they actually need to feel things too, by the way. It's interesting, I was in Ireland, you know, when they had the referendum there and I met a woman at a party. And
on abortion.
On the abortion, which was 2-3. So in Catholic Ireland, 2 out of 3 people voted for abortion. And I met a woman, I said to her, you know what's really a shame is that no one knows what they voted for. And she said, what do you mean? And I said, well, they never described an abortion during the debate. And she said, but what's the relevance of that? You know, you can't make this stuff up, you know. And she, I can tell you, she has 2 PhDs. And she asked me what the relevance was of having a description of what you were voting for as part of the conversation. And she thought that wasn't a great idea. And it's one of the things that we're most proud about in the movie, that in the movie, you know, in the court case, the jury had to have an education about what the difference between a good abortion was and murder. And it's a chilling section of the movie, and it's taken verbatim from the transcripts of the trial. And I can tell you that the jury members we spoke to were shocked and appalled by what's legal in America.
Well, just for the record as well, there were born babies whom he killed. I mean, where even, I have to believe, pro-choice people would acknowledge it was murder.
Yeah, that he induced, well, he induced women to deliver babies, and then he
would kill them.
Yes.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's very interesting. You said just know, and we have the same position. My wife's position is very interesting. She would like, more than any other law passed, a law that any woman going for an abortion simply be told about the state of what she's carrying.
That's right.
Call
that's
it a fetus, call it a baby,
yes.
Call it a moon rock.
And get pictures.
That's it. That's all.
Yep.
In other words, informed consent.
100%.
We tell people how many calories are on a menu.
Oh, yeah, and it's really important. And when we walk into a hotel in California, we find out that there might be some kind of trace of something that if you force-fed a rat for a thousand years, that the rat would die of cancer. Shocker. And we have to have that, like, right up there in the poshest hotels in L.A. But no, this woman is going to go in there, and the last thing you want to do is to show her an ultrasound. The last thing you want to do is let her hear her baby's heartbeat. One of the actors in our movie, by the way, unbelievable, by the way, she turns around and says, by the way, this is my own story, incredible story about her,
really?
About her, Tessa Watley. And she was having an abortion in Houston, and the nurse said to her, I'm going to leave you for a minute. You need to listen to your baby's heartbeat. I'm going to come back, though, and I'm going to start the procedure. And you
the
can
nurse
imagine.
Did that?
And
I
the
can't
nurse
believe
did that.
The
and the nurse
fire.
Did that. I tell you, it's against the law. It's against the rules, I should say. And the girl, she said, I put my clothes on and I went out to the car. And people can watch her video of her online. She was so beautiful. She said she stays awake. He's 5 years old now, and she stays awake at night and watches him sleep. And she can't believe that she could have destroyed something so precious.
Despite your passion on the abortion issue and this incredible movie, which, by the way, I want to just tell you folks, It's about a human being. It is about, by the way, I'll tell you what I really think it's about, the press. I think the press part in your movie is as important as the abortion part.
I totally agree with you. Yeah. And I think there'll be a lot of people who'll watch that film and be incredibly disturbed by the fact that their media, the American media, chose not to cover this trial.
What about the Philadelphia media?
Oh, no, I mean, forget, you know, everyone. But, I mean, if you think at the same time, and everyone's going to remember this, Jodi Arias was on trial at the same time. Everyone knew about Jodi Arias, as I like to say, the blow-by-blow account of her life with her boyfriend up until the end of his life. One guy died. Now, it's incredibly tragic for his family. I totally get that. But we all knew all the details, all the salacious details, by the way, of their relationship and how she killed him and all of that. At the very same time that trial was on, Kermit Gosnell was on trial for killing babies who were born alive and crickets, absolute crickets. So I think there'll be a lot of people asking questions about how complicit the media were in the cover-up, a cover-up of this story.
To hear the entire interview, go to townhallreview.com. Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up,
9% of those people will become addicted to marijuana.
The drug that keeps getting worse, when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Increasingly, states are legalizing the recreational use of marijuana. Considering the long and expensive effort to rid our country of cigarettes, this may seem odd. especially as more studies find that marijuana does damage, particularly to the brains of teenagers. Another issue rarely acknowledged, it is truly addictive. Michael Medved looks at a story of one recent high-profile example.
This is a piece in the New York Times that I'm talking about is by a guy named Neil Pollack, who's a writer. He writes very well, and he has an attention-getting headline. It's a piece about his own experience. So you can't just argue with it and say, well, this didn't happen. No, it happened. He writes about it, and he has all kinds of records to back him up. Headline is, I'm just a middle-aged house dad addicted to pot. And then the subheading says, cannabis should be legal, just as alcohol should be legal. But marijuana addiction exists, and it almost wrecked my life. Here's a story. It's Dateline Austin, Texas. My name is Neil, and I'm a marijuana addict. A year ago, I wouldn't have said that, because it would have meant giving up marijuana. I would rather have given up breathing. When I had my first cup of coffee each morning, I pressed a little button on my vape pen, waited for the blue glow, took a huge inhale, and then blew it into the mug so that I could suck in the THC and the caffeine at the same time. Then I took another hit, and another. In the afternoons, I'd smoke a bowl or pop a gummy bear, or both. That, by the way, is not the kind of gummy bear that you normally give to children. At night, I got high before eating dinner or watching the ball game. Maybe I'd stopped getting stoned a little bit before bed, but what was the point? If I went to bed high, I could wake up high, too. Like most pot addicts in denial, I spent years telling myself that marijuana isn't addictive, and so I didn't have a problem. But clearly I did. And I'm not the only one who suffers this way. Though marijuana addiction isn't deadly like opioid addiction or toxic like meth addiction, it still wastes millions of lives. Around 9% of even casual users become addicted. And about 17% of those who start as teenagers. Okay, word about these statistics that he's using. Those statistics are based on an article that was published, it might be 8 or 9 years ago, but it's an article published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. It's been looked over. It's been peer-reviewed. It is a solid article and a solid analysis. Here's what they show. That if you take the total number of even occasional marijuana users, if you take people who take even one joint, getting high once, 9% of those people, that's many, many millions of people, will become addicted to marijuana. That means that they're dependent on it. That means you have to struggle to quit. That means you have a need. Your body develops a need for marijuana. He says, I started smoking, meaning marijuana, regularly in the 1990s when I was in my mid-20s. So he didn't have that 17%. Nearly one out of five people who start using pot as teenagers become addicted. He says, I started smoking regularly in the 1990s when I was in my mid-20s. Pot made everything better. Food, music, sex, cleaning. And it made nothing worse. I got depressed less often. I laughed all the time. Sounds great, huh? Well, he goes on. But I also lost my temper for no reason. Did I yell at strangers in public? Probably. I barely remember because I was stoned all the time. But I do remember that once, high as a promotional blimp, I got into a bar fight with a former friend and broke his tooth with a beer bottle. Back when my writing career was booming, I got invited a couple of times to do readings in Amsterdam, a bad gig for a pot addict. Once, after ingesting a couple of THC pills, I dumped a pitcher of water over my head and insulted the Iraqi representative to National Poetry Day Amsterdam. Another time, I pulled down my pants and flashed a crowd of several hundred. If I had any boundaries, we'd erase them thoroughly. The boom in my writing career ended fast. My son was born in 2002. I didn't have an office job, so I was around a lot to get high and enjoy the cartoons. See, that's scary. Doesn't it sound scary to you? I mean, I understand that he's taking care of his son, and that's a nice thing, I guess. But if you're sitting there watching cartoons with your kid and enjoying it because you're so stoned that your mind is not functioning. He goes on, I opened a packet of Reefer's peanut butter cups. Okay, this is a product. Jeremy, do you know anything about Reefer's peanut butter cups? I can only guess. I opened a packet of Reefer's peanut butter cups at his preschool fundraiser and stunk up the place. But pot wasn't just an occasional funny thing for me to do on weekends. I got stoned the day my son came home from the hospital. And I stayed that way, with few breaks, for a decade and a half. Of course I put him in danger, because I couldn't stop getting high. I was a drug addict. Look, this is one of those things. I mean, there's some things that are really, really difficult to figure out in the world. But honestly, if you think about it, think about how much better it is not to be addicted to some substance.
I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Coming up.
After all, I know this is amazing to Democrats. We feel as passionately as you do. I know you can't believe that because we're so much more civil than you. So you don't really believe that we feel as passionately about things as you do.
Dennis Prager with the final segment of the Town Hall Review in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Hawaii Senator Mazie Hirono implied that it's okay for mobs to harass and intimidate Republicans with whom they disagree politically. And now Eric Holder has stated explicitly that when they go low, we kick them.
No. When they go low, we kick them. That's what this new Democratic Party is about.
It's a troubling theme running through the entire Democratic Party at this moment. Here's Dennis Prager.
Dana Bash interviewing the senator from Hawaii, who is one of the more, well, it's not true. They're all equally left. Okay, let's hear this. This is priceless.
President and Republicans, what they are saying is that Democratic protesters are, quote, an angry mob. And what I want to ask you about is, you know, it is one thing to
protest. It's a laugh. It's a laugh.
To do it at the Capitol. That's been done for generations. Yes. And frankly, since the founding of this country. It's another thing to run senators out of restaurants, go to their homes. Is that going too far?
I think that it just means that there are a lot of people who are very, very much motivated. But what is going on?
Because if that does not disqualify this woman from serious moral consideration, nothing does. Do you think that Republican senators seeing right-wing mobs go into restaurants and start screaming and cursing at Democratic officials, you think they would say, well, it just shows people are motivated? Do you understand the moral rot at the heart of the left? Every day I bring you an example. I'd like to know how any of you on the left, not liberals, liberals just are naive, but leftists are truly damaging. But so I just want to know, how do you how do you assimilate in your conscience what the this Democratic senator has said? How do you feel about these people who go into restaurants and start screaming at a Republican senator, for example, like they did with Ted Cruz, a fellow senator? See, I'm torn right now. Would I advocate on the air that people do to Senator Hirono what was done to Senator Cruz? See, I can't do that because I have standards. But I am curious what she would say if it happened to her. After all, I know this is amazing to Democrats. We feel as passionately as you do. I know you can't believe that because we're so much more civil than you. So you don't really believe that we feel as passionately about things as you do.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of the Town Hall Review. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producers Charlie Richards, David Posian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, and Generalissimo Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.